So good morning, Stephen. Welcome to my radio podcast. How are you this morning?
Very good. Have you just hijacked my podcast?
I clearly have. So,
Good.
Stephen, do you want to introduce yourself to the audience, to all
Sure.
of our listeners?
My name is Steve. I'm the CTO of Itabu. And would you like to introduce yourself, Felix?
Yeah, my name is Felix Wetzel. I'm hosting here my weekly podcast, The Felix and Steve Show.
Woo, 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 woo. Yeah, but you've hijacked my podcast. Felix.
So Steve, if I understand it correctly, you're not just the CTO, you also set up Edibu, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so we set up in 2007, and the business that founded Itabu was set up in 2003. And Itabu, of course, I set up with Martin in 2007, who's the MD.
And what made you come up with the idea of Edibu or starting a business?
We had so One World Market was a web development agency, and we had quite a few recruitment agencies on our books, and they said, "Why don't you start a job poster?" And we said, "What's a job poster?" And they said, "Well, go and look at Broadbean and Conkers." And the overall basic market analysis that came back was that Broadbean was expensive and Conkers was too techie. I think Conkers had been built by techies. Anyway, that was a market feedback we got. It was all pretty rough and ready at the time. So we put together a very basic posting system in about 3 months and got to market and launched at market with some crazy ideas like £59 per month unlimited users, which was a ridiculous thing to do. But it did get a foot in the door, did get us into the market. And then as we realized that was a very unscalable business, we then followed what most of the other suppliers were doing and went on user-based pricing. But that's how we got into it was we were working with recruitment agents and they said, "You should be doing this," which is a good way to start, a good reason to start a business when you have clients asking you to start something.
Yeah, I think that's great because I guess immediately you had clients on board that could also help you with what they precisely wanted, correct?
Yes.
Now, in the market, obviously Broadbean, Conkers, Edibu, you mentioned the other two as your main competitors. If you look from the outside into the marketplace of multi-posters, they all seem to be relatively the same. So what would you say is Edibu's differentiator between Broadbean and Conkers?
I think we are ahead of the curve in terms of seeing job posting forming a part of the overall candidate attraction landscape, and that advertising is part of an overall marketing strategy that's being executed by an agency or an in-house brand. And I think how we, while people say that job posting is commoditized, and I don't wholly agree with that, but as people say that posting's commoditized, we have added other services around that to attract candidates, and as you know, we're also developing a lot of tech which lets you engage with candidates more effectively. So you spend a lot of money on a lot of advertising buck to find that candidate, typically with a job board, but could now of course be pay-per-click or via the aggregators. Once you've got that candidate, you may not place them, but you want to keep them and keep them loyal to your brand. And I think where Itabu is pushing ahead is in that area. And that area it's a developing area. It hasn't matured as yet. And you have people like Greg Savage singing that is the future. And we believe it is the future. Much more programmatic, much more focused, and building up talent pools. But at the end of the day, there's still a big market for job posting, and I don't think job posting is really going to go anywhere. But that, to answer your question, we are much more an overall marketing. We have a much more of a marketing approach and a relationship building approach to the attraction engagement of candidates.
Steve, you said that job postings might disappear in the future. My question here is now, what do you think, how would companies attract candidates without job postings?
Well, there's a question to you. I'm not sure that job boards are going to disappear. I think there may be fewer of them, but if you look at what a job poster does, it transfers data from one point to multiple points. And the legacy paradigm has been you send out an advert to a job board, people find those adverts and apply. Now, there may be a change of how people find the information about a job, but they're still going to be going to technologically independent entities. And what a job poster does is it sends that data to these independent entities, whether it's a job board or a social network or a company website or aggregator services. So I'm not sure that the job posters will become irrelevant, but there may be a change of description in what we do in how we send data. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I think, job advertising will still play a role also in the future, especially for smaller companies who don't have a big brand, to attract candidates. And I don't believe that, that everything will be just sourcing and engagement, just purely from the candidates, perspective. They don't want to engage the entire time with the different potential employers. But it will be interesting. So when you said beforehand, I just want to go back to something you said before. We said you are ahead of the curve. Now, a company can be, or a person can be ahead of the curve and be so far ahead of the curve that nobody understands what they're doing. Or are you just ahead of the curve that is you're leading the pack to some, to the new promised land?
Well, I think we've gone a bit too far ahead, and we're looking to the market still wants job posting, and the market is talking about candidate engagement, but I don't think that the recruitment market in particular, perhaps different in the in-house world is different. Perhaps the in-house world is much further on, but I don't think the agency market is talking about candidate engagement. I don't think that market's doing much about candidate engagement, and we've seen that with some of the talks that we put on. You see a lot of people nodding, and there's a lot of talk around the relationship that you generate and nurture with the candidate. I think in reality, people are still working pretty much as they used to.
So not really a big change, even how they worked pre-digital times.
Pre-digital, I wouldn't be the best person to say, but I just think in the last 5 years you've had this shift to candidate is king. And there's so much talk about the candidate engagement. You see it everywhere when you go to the shows. But I don't the actual practices I don't think have changed that much. There are agencies who are also, ahead of the curve, and they will be getting the best candidates because they are effectively engaging with them. But by and large, I don't think there's been a huge shift as yet, but it will come.
Okay. And obviously last year, one of the big, or this year actually, one of the big news item was Google going into the job space with Google for Jobs and Google Hire. How does that work with EDB? Could I, with Google for Jobs, have you integrated with Google already? Or do you plan to integrate? And what's your view in general about Google for Jobs?
My view is that it's quite a big unknown as yet. I think they are going to create more choice because they're one of their big motives is to be dealing with people like Indeed. So there's going to be a big scrap with big players, and that's going to be interesting to behold. It's worrying, and also it could be good for job boards, but certainly Google's play will be to deal with entities like Indeed, I believe. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I generally am always a little bit hesitant of having too much power concentrated in too few hands. So I, you know, in if everything just goes via Amazon and Google and Facebook, that would be a shame.
Yeah.
And I think it would take away some of the vitality of the internet. So that's my main worry with it, you know, because like I think we don't really know how it's going to work out. Obviously, there's a threat that Google could become overbearingly strong. But my main worry is, you know, is the internet then, you know, becomes too one-dimensional? I guess like it was with AOL and CompuServe. And I guess we can also take some good learning that while at some stage people thought AOL and CompuServe was the internet, it then changed completely differently. So, you know, maybe there's hope then that there's some world after Google.
Yeah, well, I think you know my opinion on this, but I'll repeat it as we're podcasting. Which is that when everything gets too big, it's always the precursor to the next phase. And I think the stories I told you before were when I was working in the internet backbone industry in the late 90s and going for a meeting with, I think it was Yahoo. It was Yahoo. And trying to get them to do business with us. We were a big player internet backbone services. We're an exchange point. And they, you know, they were sitting across the desk looking at us saying, why should we do business with you? And of course, Yahoo went down. And then when we were setting up Idaboo with a very large job board that I won't name, but it was just the same. You couldn't see any way that there's just a general cockiness that comes with becoming so big. And as omnipotent as people like Google seem, as do Facebook, I still think I don't think they'll beat that trend. They may turn into utility companies or become sort of the General Motors of the internet. I don't know if you saw when you look at the history of certain businesses, they all tend to evolve around the same time. So you look at car businesses, you know, all around the same decade, tech companies too. So the Google Facebooks will probably be around forever as far as we're concerned, but they will fade into the background of becoming the Me Toos as there's new layers of innovative tech that's built on top of what they produced, but it's stuff that they can't really emulate. And the world moves on. And what will be amazing if we're talking in say 10 years time is, you know, whether, you know, the big five as they're now called in the internet space, if any of those turn into the Yahoos.
Yes. Well, Yahoo is still around, obviously, but it kind of is faded in the back.
Yeah. Yahoo is still around.
And I guess the interesting part is, you know, we never know what comes out of China because we're only very much focused on what comes out of the US. And it's another interesting point because you're living in Thailand. Have you, you know, what do you see happening with a more, let's say, more Eastern perspective?
Well, developing countries around Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, I mean, Thailand's still fairly closed as a country. You've got Cambodia, Vietnam developing a bit more open in terms of how they look to the world. Asia is such a big place and it's so fragmented. It's difficult to describe it. Of course, everything that we're doing at Idaboo is focused mainly on Australia and Australia and Singapore. Mm-hmm. You know, Japan looks like a very interesting market to get into. China, I think everyone's now retired from the idea that China was a good idea. People have sort of come running out with a tail between their legs. But you know, Asia is a fascinating place. It's just you see different systems working out here. For example, people don't have email, they use messaging.
Mm-hmm.
So because of the way that the markets have evolved at different point at different points in time compared to what's happened in Europe, there's been adoption of different techs, such as messaging.
Mm-hmm. What I always find remarkable, I've looked at a map, I think it was last week, about internet connectivity in different countries. And you have countries in Africa where over 60% of the population don't even have access to electricity, which is remarkable. Or maybe it's not remarkable, it's remarkable from my perspective because we are so used to having electricity, like us talking over the internet and recording this podcast.
Yeah.
And then there's whole parts of the world that are actually not even thinking or having the access to what we're discussing. And, you know, you have the entire debate about artificial intelligence. Well, artificial intelligence can only take hold in countries where you have electricity and access to the internet.
But you're saying those countries in Africa don't have net access?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Significant percentage of the population doesn't have internet access. Some don't even have no access to electricity.
Interesting when you take somewhere like that, though, and you talk about the way technology gets used at different points in time. So in Africa, I think online banking was the first place it was launched was Africa in terms of financial trades happening mobile to mobile. It was all driven in Africa, my understanding is, via SMS.
Okay. And so the HR tech market or the recruiting market, how does the Asian part compare to Europe and the US? Is it more advanced or is it different or is it less advanced? What would you say?
That's a very good question. I think I should need time to prepare for that question.
Okay. Well, but,
my observations of Asia so far is that you have, if you take somewhere like Thailand, you've got the big players here, the big players that you'd know, such as your Adecco's or Robert Walters. But then you have the local players. And that's when you get big differences. And also, being a vendor in the recruitment space, it's much more difficult to be selling into that space. So in Hong Kong, Singapore, as soon as you get into the localized market, how they approach software products, it's very, very different to Europe. I mean, Australia is much more similar to the UK, unsurprisingly. But you do see a big difference between the international agency markets, which is fairly homogenized, and then the localized markets, which are completely different.
And could you give us and our listeners some examples of these differences?
Probably the belief of using free stuff, getting away with a Google spreadsheet as opposed to buying software to manage candidates, as an example.
And you think that's more culturally driven, or do you think it's just because they are not at that size where they need it yet, or where they can still get away with using a Google spreadsheet?
Well, if you're talking about the poorer countries, countries with lower salaries. If you take someone like India, for example, we've talked to people that wanted to take Idabu into India. But if you are making a percentage as an agency on a very, very small salary, then, the value of what you're going to have as an agency business as you make placements is much lower. So I think there is a generalized trend where a market will start to pay for software products that improve their productivity to get the job done, as the revenue they're going to take from the placement commissions goes up, and there's a threshold. Somewhere like India is still below that threshold unless you're dealing with international placements or very top end placements. Yeah. And you've got the same, pretty much the same in Thailand, though it's going up. That's a generalized, you know, generalized trend.
Okay. Now, you know, Steve, you've obviously, you're British and you lived in the UK, then you moved to Barcelona and now you move to Thailand. Why Thailand? What made you go from Barcelona? Loads of people here in Britain would say, oh, Barcelona is so beautiful. I want to go there. And you moved on. Why? What was the reason for that?
Well, 2008 happened, the financial crash. And around 2011, 2012, Barca, which is a amazing city and a great place to live, unfortunately, the unemployment was getting higher there, and it was a bit depressing when everyone was unemployed, or I think it was 26% unemployment. And it was a case of looking around and going, well, the future, you know, everyone's saying that the future is going to be in Asia. Let's get over to Asia and take a look. Thailand was because there was a friend living here. And Thailand, you know, Bangkok is in a great location. You're only 6 hours away from the UK. Go south, you can hit Singapore. Go northeast, you get over to Hong Kong in a couple of hours. You're not too far from Australia. It's a really great location. So I definitely didn't want to be living in the major cities, but wanted access to them. And then I think Thailand as a country, it's got a good standard of living. It's, you know, very reasonably priced. It's not utopia. It has, you know, problems as any country does, but it has a reasonable level of sophistication so that you've got decent hospitals and stuff that you want access to. But it hasn't become overdeveloped as yet.
And have you been to Thailand before you made the decision to go to Thailand?
No, it was just roll the dice. But you know me, Felix, that's the way I like it.
Absolutely, a restless soul. So when you're going to stay there now for a while, or do you intend to move on?
Stay here for the moment. But you know, life is about traveling around, and what's great with the work we're doing with Idabu is getting out to Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore. Obviously, I'm over in Europe a lot. So here is a great base. My kids are in a great international school here. So for the moment, it works. But it also works because I'm lucky enough to be able to travel around and be in different places. I think if I was just stuck here all the time, it would get a bit boring.
And would you ever consider coming back to Britain again, to the UK?
Well, I probably I do. Should we talk about that?
Of course, you know. I mean, we could. I always find, you know, in these interviews, if we're just talking about business, that's interesting. But what I find is that people and our listeners also would like to know a little bit more about the person behind the technologies. And as part of the person behind it, it's also about, you know, what do they think about. You know, problems and issues and questions and topics that are currently current mm-hmm. that everybody discusses. And for us here in the UK, it's always good to see, to have like a traveler like yourself telling us how it looks from the outside. Because so often you know it from business. If you're looking just too much inside, you lose touch and you don't see and feel the trends and the waves and the rhythms of the world.
Mm. Yeah, of course, if you're not inside London and those central hubs, you can also miss some of the key rhythms that are going on. So as is always the case, there's the upside and the downside with all situations. Anyway, to answer your question, I don't have any desire to go back to the UK at all, but I do love going back to the UK. And after not living there now for 15 years almost, 15 years, in fact, 16 soon. One of the things that is lovely is an appreciation of the fauna and, you know, and the UK countryside, because you go there and it is very, very special. But when you grow up, if you grow up there, it just seems like the usual stuff. So oak trees and all that sort of stuff is box standard. But weirdly enough, in the last couple of years, when going back there, I have had an appreciation of the nature of the UK, and it's a great country. It has lots going on, but when moving to Barcelona, I remember people saying, "What do you think you're going to do? You're going to come back to the UK?" And I think what happens when you move country, and you can comment on this. I think when you move country, you realize that there isn't a sort of binary system between the country you've moved to and where you came from. It opens your eyes that actually there's all these other places to explore in the world. So my objective, you know, you say, do you want to stay in Thailand forever? Well, the overall answer to that question is no, I wouldn't really want to stay anywhere forever. But if you have a base that you can move around from, then fantastic. That is for me is my personal dream. So lots of other countries to go and live in.
So one of the things that I also would like to explore a little bit further with you is identity.
Yeah.
Because obviously with me having lived in different countries and now living here in the UK, I'd recently had a conversation and about national identity, and I actually don't feel any national identity, you know, besides if it comes to football, then I'm fiercely German. But otherwise, you know, I don't feel German. I don't feel British. I don't feel Spanish. I'm just me. How is it with you? Do you still have this, you know, some people obviously, you know, very patriotic and, well, nationalist, not in a negative sense, but have this feeling like I am British. So I couldn't say anymore like I am German. I'm German in my passport, but that's about it. How do you see that, Steve? How do you feel?
I feel the same as you. I don't have any particular identity. It sounds a bit stupid, but you feel, well, as you meet loads of people from so many different countries and you're immersed in that, then it, seeing yourself coming from this singular place, it kind of erodes away, I think.
Yes. So eroding away slowly, the water is, you know, cutting away the edges.
But how do you feel about that? Because I know you were worried when Brexit came through, and I know we don't really know what's going to happen as yet. Well, no one really knows, but that was something that did make you question your identity.
Yes, exactly. And I think that was for me a big part of also the, you know, the whole, are you a citizen of the world? Is a citizen of nowhere? You know, going through these motions and thinking like, you know, what is my identity? Am I German? Am I British? Who am I? Mm-hmm. And that's why I came out, you know, for me, it was like more, well, it's a passport. That's my, you know, that's my identity. And I don't link citizenship to a passport. I link citizenship being actively involved in a community. Mm-hmm. That could be the community where I live, but it's not exclusive to it. It's also the community that, you know, like that we belong to, you know, the international recruitment team that's a community for me as well. And it's like, you know, if you're part of this community, this is what where your identity comes from, not from a passport or what politicians say or borders. But you know, so for me, it's like, who am I? You know, whenever you're always being asked, like, who are you? It's like, you know, I'm ultimately an immigrant. I'm a serial offender in immigration, because, you know, I'd live in different countries, but I'm not a digital native because of, so I'm immigrant by date of birth. I, you know, emigrated into marketing. I emigrated into recruitment, you know, but it's nice. It's like borderless. You just, you know, see what happens next. And the interesting bit is that wherever you are, there's always purists or fascists who want to keep you out. Mm-hmm. And it can be in a profession. It can be in, you know, in a country. But then there's also lots of people who just kind of welcome the new perspectives. And yeah, that's how I see myself. So how would you answer the question, who are you?
Well, I'm very unnationalistic, that's for sure. I think you, as you get older, one of the things that is great is you lose the need to have to define yourself as who you are too much. The media, of course, use identity as a way of galvanizing, and politicians obviously use it as a way as galvanizing and grouping people. And as soon as you create a group, then by definition, you can define people that are not in your group, and then you can start to create enmity between them. So identity, it's a very good question. It's a very good question. I think you just have a sort of personal, difficult to describe because you start sounding a bit hippy dippy about it, but I think.
Why not?
Well, I think most of us understand that we belong to a global community, and there are a lot of problems with that. And we're seeing people wanting to separate, and they're wanting to separate for not all bad reasons. People see an erosion of their control. That's what they perceive. But humans are evolving towards the global community is getting smaller and smaller. So we need to work out how we're going to get on, and we need to have our identities that fit that sort of model. That's how I feel.
Well, the interesting thing, what really struck me is what you just said about the older they get, the less need you have to define yourself.
Yeah, well, maybe. That's me. I was going to say, sorry to interrupt, but that's how I feel. I think age gives you more confidence. Identity, I mean, we do all have identity for sure. I mean, for example, I do like the fact that I've started a business. That's massively enshrined as part of my identity. If you took that away from me tomorrow, then I would suffer feeling of identity loss, because when you talk to people, that's the anchor point. That's what you do. And you, I know that you have that with the work that you do. If that was suddenly taken away for some reason, that would cause a lot of that would cause you some sort of form of suffering.
Yes.
So we kind of, as we get older, I guess we tend to identify with how we develop often our working lives. We both got kids, so we massively identify with being dads. But the bit that I find a contradiction is when you look at identity and you then see people, often older people, who seem to identify with certain groups very, very strongly. And there's an irony that I see with people that come out to Thailand. They've come out and they've retired. So they've retired, nothing wrong with that. They've retired, they're living out in Thailand, and I love listening to these conversations where they're very often, would be pushing for Brexit. So they're keen to separate people. And they will talk about the problems of immigration in the UK and these people come into their country who can't speak English. As they sit there and they're an immigrant in Thailand and they can't speak a word of Thai. And they then, yes, in the next conversation, start slagging off the Thais who don't understand them. And you're saying, well, do you know how to ask for a pound of apples at the market or a kilo of apples? And they're like, no. So their identity seems to be very wrapped up with still having a sort of rights mentality from the UK, or wherever they come from, not just the UK, by the way, lots of countries, but typically European countries. Yeah, strong identities, and also completely daft in how they view the world and double standards. That was putting it politely, because I don't think we can swear on the podcast, can we?
Oh, we can do whatever we want.
Oh, great.
So if you want to swear, you can now repeat it again with swear words if you wish to. I think, if necessary, we can put a warning.
Explicit.
Warning up.
Explicit, yeah. Podcast content.
Exactly. So, Steve, obviously, I also know that you know you're reading massive amounts, you're listening to loads of podcasts. What's currently, what's currently the book or the podcast that is, or the ideas, the thoughts that inspire you and that you think people should ever look at?
Well, Sam Harris. Have you listened to any of the Sam Harris podcasts?
No, I don't know him at all. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about Sam Harris?
I don't know that much about him as yet, but I can tell you that he is some people would put him forward as one of the big thinkers of our time. Very, very interesting guy. Check out his podcast. I haven't listened to that many as yet, but he is very, very sharp, very engaging. Listen to a couple. He is interviewing someone who's talking about Buddhism. He has a lot of focus on mindfulness and meditation and those sort of areas. Very, very interesting guy. Goes into things like the nature of consciousness, interviews people on his podcast. Very, very interesting. So I highly recommend Sam Harris, who was recommended by a friend recently. Tim Ferriss is still going strong. I think Tim Ferriss is great. The interviews are great. And there was one recently by, what's his name, Terrence? I think his name is Terrence, and he unfortunately passed away recently. He's a swimmer. Let me just find it.
Okay.
Yeah, Terry Laughlin. Terry Laughlin,
okay.
Rather. He set up, he taught people to swim called Total Immersion, and Tim Ferriss did a podcast with him recently, and that was amazing. It was 2 weeks before he died. He had stage 4 cancer, and he talks you through his techniques of what he learned coaching swimming teams. And yeah, if you're interested in business or life in general, then you should go and speak, go and listen to that podcast. It was very good. It gives you an appreciation of life, but also the techniques that he talks about with how to swim. And if you want to swim fast, then swim slow. There's great messages in there that I think people like.
That's what I always like about Tim Ferriss's interviews, that I think, you know, it touches so many, his guests and him in their conversation touch on so many different topics. So, for example, the one with Mr. Money Mustache.
Yeah.
Which is one of my personal favorites of Tim Ferriss's podcasts. Because again, you can learn so much individually, but also for business or whatever interests you. But I guess that's the thing. If you have a strong message, you can ultimately utilize it for everything.
What was your number one takeaway from Mr. Money Mustache?
The first one, I can't remember precisely what it's what they're called, but where you yourself making a conscious decision of cutting something back, and while it might at the beginning feel tough, it actually gets easier and easier with the time. And the other item that I had is like just these easy calculations. If you drink a cup of, I don't know, if you buy a coffee every day from Starbucks, how much you could save if you wouldn't buy this cup of coffee over a year. And it just always astounds me. And I do it always myself in my head, then kind of saying like, well, do I really want to buy this? And if I would buy this, you know, if I wouldn't buy this for every single day for the next year, how much money would I save? Because for me, you know, financial independence and the freedom that comes with it is obviously a phenomenal goal.
Yeah, well, that's a whole podcast in itself. We could definitely rant about that for hours.
We shall do that.
Yeah, but and connected very much with not living in the UK, being outside of that culture, it is much easier to disengage from consumerism and the need to keep buying new stuff. It's much easier, I think, living outside the UK to be able to do that in a place like Thailand or one of the neighboring countries.
Well, it's interesting. I spoke yesterday. I had a discussion with friends about artificial intelligence and the impact of it. And what you see with artificial intelligence is will be such a culture change that ultimately every time the way that we see the world or think about the world now we need to change. And one of the topics that always came up here, but what do I do if I don't have a job? How do I get my where do I get my recognition from or my identity from? Where do we get money from? And it's like, I think it's so inbuilt in us, this whole capitalist thriving for better, more, faster, that it's very difficult for people to switch off, but would be very, very healthy for people to switch off from time to time or completely if they could.
Yes, it's difficult to see how that will change. So where do you think people's identities will go to? Because undoubtedly then there's going to be a fairly black period where people are not sure how to re-identify themselves in the absence of work, or work being their main identifier. How do you think that's going to play out?
I don't know, but it will be very, very interesting. I think, see, I agree, everybody needs to have a reason or recognition or, you need to hold yourself in a higher self-regard. And I think, Brexit, Trump, all of these more inward movements are for me also driven because of the need to, or the loss of identity. And yes, I think we are in danger of going through a dark period, and we're in danger of, hopefully not repeating the same as we had, that led to two world wars. But we're in the same kind of shift. We're seeing the same underlying strong shifts. And then you obviously look at other countries like, let's say, Saudi Arabia, where, the state has this cradle to grave system where its citizens don't need to work. They more work because so that they have something to do. And that obviously breeds a completely different set of radicalism, because, you still need to find meaning. And then, is the meaning in religion? So, to answer your question, I don't know. I only know that we need to develop a new way of thinking, which I think will emerge while we go through these times. And we just need to restrain ourselves not to lash out too hard if something doesn't work out in the first place.
Yeah, you talk about podcasts, and of course, Dan Carlin. Have you listened to Dan Carlin's Hardcore Histories?
I've listened to some of it, yes.
Yeah, so if you go and spend the time listening to what's it called? I forget the name. Something Armageddon, and it's a 6-part series on the First World War. And I always find it interesting talking to Europeans who will point outwardly at, say, atrocities or things going on around the rest of the world, but kind of seem oblivious to the fact that the bloodiest, worst wars in the history of the world typically have all happened in France. A lot of them, when you look at the battles, the pitch battles in the trench warfare in World War One, it was, there's still areas in France apparently where I forget the name of the area, but there's about, there's still a, they've ex, they excavated a million shells that hadn't exploded. And they estimate there's still a million more for them to excavate until the area is safe. So for years, you had farmers blowing up as they ploughed their field near the trench warfare areas because of all these unexploded mines, etc. It's just amazing. So the devastation that has occurred historically. And the Europeans are often pointing their finger around the world saying, oh, they're bad, check out what they're doing, without really looking at themselves. And then what frustrates me, ranting a bit, but what frustrates me when we talk about things like Brexit is the question is not really about your economy or fairly trivial things like the price of your house or anything like that. And personally speaking, I think the European leaders are pretty awful, and the fact that they haven't listened to anyone in their community is a great shame. I think the European leaders have had a big part to play in allowing a Brexit situation to happen. But both the English and English government and the European Parliament, or European leaders rather, should realize that what they're playing with, if it goes wrong, when it's gone wrong historically, it's been absolutely terrible. And as you said, the change that's going on at the moment is creating those same the same uncertainty. And it seems like it couldn't happen, but it has happened, and history has a tendency to repeat itself. So I just think that people who are worrying about straight bananas, I think that's a bit of a, people have now said that no one's, was that a joke, the straight bananas? I think it was just a joke, but let's use it as an example. But anyone worrying about a straight banana, there's much bigger things to worry about.
Indeed. So, Steve, but I want to leave our listeners with on a high note. So, do you have a mantra that you live by?
Yeah, do it now.
Do it now. Boom. That's good. So, thanks, Steve Walker, CTO and founder of Edibu.
I thought this was my podcast, really. Okay,
mine, yours. You know, these are such old, outdated terms.
Yeah, well
thanks,
that's true.
Steve, for letting me host your podcast and interviewing you. And you know, I can only, you know, to all of our listeners say, if you ever have the chance of meeting Steve, go and see him, go and meet him, speak with him. He's an absolutely, you know, super guy who I really, really rate and have lots of fun talking to, as you hopefully all have realized here with this podcast.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, and see you next week for Steve and Felix's second part.
Hey, cheers, Felix. See you later.